This is the Kinky Cast, an adult, sexually explicit podcast. If you are under 18 years old, please stop the podcast now. This is episode 111 of our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. We welcome guests with opposing viewpoints. Today, our guest is Galen Foose, author and kinky counselor. Here's your hosts, Woody and the Beast.
Thanks, Max, and welcome to another edition of the Kinky Cast. Tonight, sitting next to me is the Beast. Welcome back again.
I am glad to be back in the studio.
Boy, you were down. You left me driving here all by myself.
Oh, I was needing a driver. Yeah, trying to work during all of that.
Well, 'tis the season to have maladies. I have a head cold tonight, so forgive me for my sound.
Well, Kate tried to kill me during that. She showed me a puppy monkey baby. And I took a laughing, coughing fit, and I saw my world narrowing because of my lack of oxygen.
Oh, yes.
It wasn't, and I still owe her for that. Well, I also owe the people that created that.
Borrow some of her oxygen, I think.
Yeah. But puppy, monkey, baby. Yeah. Whoever thought? Anyway. Tonight, Woody, we got an author with us.
We haven't had an author in a while.
We haven't had an author, and the book looks fantastic. And I know it's on my to-read list now. We have Galen Foose with us, and his new book is Decoding Your Kink. Afternoon, Galen.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Happy to connect with you.
We're happy to have you here. You are a therapist, right?
That's correct.
How did you get into kink therapy?
Well, it's a long story, but it all combines together, or it all for me wove together by having a personal interest and fascination and desire and innate sexuality that was kinky, which I covered up, obscured, hid, ducked for most of my adult life till my mid-40s. Then I decided I was going through a relationship change, and at that point I decided to get real about my sexuality of kink. So that started me on the journey into kink, and then along the way, other threads started to weave together to where I began to recognize, along with my interest in psychology and process work, one kind of, personal work on another, that kink and psychotherapy had many overlapping contexts. So the part of it is being the fact that most people do hide, tuck away, don't want to be honest about their sexuality, particularly an alternative sexuality like kink, and therefore they're pushing it down below the surface, and that means it's leaking out in other ways or being repressed in ways that aren't healthful and aren't liberating and such. So, I mean, by the time I started to engage more and more with people and in community and other aspects, I just started to become aware of that this is a very complex lifestyle. It's not, for many people anyway, it's not so easy. And it's also a beautiful, as I look at it, because by leaning into your authentic sexuality, you are going to also be leaning into all the parts of myself or oneself that has been hiding, covering up, has been fearful, has been ashamed, has been judgmental about it. And those need to be cleared up in order to, like, fully, authentically embrace your kinky sexuality.
So there's a lot of personal closeting going on there that you have to come out to yourself before you can come out to other people.
Some people don't really think about it or engage at this level, but, I went on and got a master's in transpersonal psychology and started to open up this more because I was encountering people who were struggling to not retreat from their strides into kink because they were being assaulted internally by judgment, fear, shame, guilt, somehow couldn't hold together. Like, how can I be kinky and also be a good parent, be a good worker, own a business, and be a good boss, or go to the PTA meeting and such, and also be, you know, a dominant erotic sadist who likes to, you know, torture, beat, abuse, consensually, of course, another person.
You left church out of there.
My mistake. I'm sorry. You know, it was intentional, you know.
We've seen so many people that are conflicted about their religion and kink.
Yeah, that's a great example of what I'm talking about. Of people, how do I hold these two distinct aspects of who I am that seem totally opposite or unable to blend together? And that's probably the core of my practice, is helping people understand the paradox, how to, the sacred and the profane aspects of this are the reality, not an either or monotheistic point of view. And that's where people get stuck in these polarities and been immersed in a monotheistic kind of system where things are good or evil, sacred or profane, or civilized or primitive, versus no, we are all of those things, really. I mean, and to some degree and another. But mostly one has dominated the other. And that's where people are struggling to stop being dominated by the fear, judgment, shame, guilt, hiding, you know, the fear of discovery, all that.
And American society would not put any of those problems on us, would it?
No, not in this culture. This is the liberated world here.
Yeah, well.
Except for 90% of the laws, legal systems, social structures, and all that. But otherwise, yeah.
Yeah, well, we did get the right for same-sex couples to marry.
Yeah, but not if everybody gets their way.
No, there are still people fighting it.
I mean, that's the thing, is like the next administration rolling around, everything could change again. Whatever strides have been made politically, socially, legally, that's another whole hot topic. My sense is the population is really emerging growingly in a sex positive, kink positive way. Examples, 50 Shades of Grey, you know, 120 million or something like that books sold. You know, the consciousness is starting to include alternative sexualities, as well as the long history that started from the gay and lesbian liberation movement in the 50s forward. You know, that was really the beginning of the sexual liberation movement, was the men and women and those communities who finally just had to get political, had to stand up for themselves, had to speak out, had to push back against the legal and political structures and the psychological, you know, structures, i.e. the American Psychological or Psychiatry Association, you know, listing homosexuality as a psychological disorder. You know, that took a long time to get cured. So, I mean, well, there's been great advances, I believe, and hopefully there's not going to be setbacks.
A situation where the word alternative sexuality is no longer used?
What would be in its place?
Sexuality.
Oh, I see. I think there's a spectrum where that might be true, but there's still a long part of the spectrum that it wouldn't be true at all. And then there's the spectrum where that's the best way to coin it, I think. Or I think I like your point, or I would resonate with that. I mean, yeah, it should just be sexuality is this diversity. You know, it isn't one thing. It's not a narrow channel. It's a very broad channel.
It isn't missionary style on Saturday night only.
Yeah, that's my preference. You know, I think that should be the law, really.
Well, there are places where we're further out to make that the law.
Yeah.
You have multiple websites. Do you want to give our listeners those websites so they can find them?
Well, my website around what we've mostly been talking about, which is the nature of sexuality, the nature of kink, the therapeutic processes or ways that people can learn to heal from ways they've been wounded, traumatized, shamed around their sexuality. All that aspect of what I do is on my website, galenfous.com. GALENFOUS.com. My book, Decoding Your Kink, I have another book called The Sharp Edge of Love that was published in 2000. That's also on the book. just to throw it out since we're on that topic. Additionally, I'm also the inventor, designer of the Tetris 3-in-1 portable dungeon, suspension bondage rig, and sex swing, which has also been a business I've operated since the year 2000. The website for that is Tetris.com, TETRUSS.com.
I've seen those in action. They're really quite a rig.
Oh, well, thank you. They've been around a long time, and we've been serving the kink community globally since 2000, so we've got quite a few places that Tetris is known.
For our listeners, it's a large tripod. What's the material? Is it aluminum?
Yeah, it's an aluminum alloy, a special blend of aluminum alloy that has very high strength, the weight ratio. So the beauty of why I designed it, because I was traveling and in hotels, and I'd sit around wondering, what could I have with me that I could have in this hotel room here that was portable, lightweight, freestanding? And that led, actually, I had been a kind of a student, admirer of Buckminster Fuller back in the 70s and 80s, and he was all about the tetrahedron as the basic structure of the universe and the strongest structural unit that there was. So I started playing around with making a tetrahedronal. Then at first it was a tetrahedron. It had a base and the three sides, and that's what a tetrahedron is, a four-sided triangle structure. According to Fuller, the Tetris was the minimum amount of enclosure to enclose space. You needed six edges, four vertices, and that was the minimum that you needed to enclose space fully. You know, we lived in mostly a cubic mentality, so people think of cubes, but the tetrahedron, based on triangular 60-degree coordinates rather than 90-degree enclosed space. So anyway, that evolved into the Tetris eventually, which is a high-strength aluminum, lightweight. It only weighs about 20 pounds.
Wow.
You can pick it up with two fingers, but it'll hold over 300 pounds live weight. That's dynamic weight, you know, over 1,500 pounds static weight. So it's really got an excellent safety record and track record in that regard. But it's also, because it's 3-in-1, you know, it can be dungeon-oriented toy, like a equivalent of a St. Andrew's cross, or you can make a spanking bench out of it. You can also use it as a shibari-type suspension rig, you know, as a basically it's a portable hardpoint. Or you can use it with accessories like thigh stirrups and a back leather back strap as like a sex swing.
So versatile, so little time.
So little time. We'll have to come back to this at some future date. I'm looking at your website, and I see a quote. I am committed to creating a world where you feel safe, normal, and encouraged to consciously express your authentic sexuality. That's from you, isn't it?
That's correct. That's my mission statement.
This book that you just released in November, Decoding Your Kink, that is a step in that direction, isn't it?
As I look at it, and my experience of it is, and I think when it's at its best, it is a complex sexuality. You know, it's not a simple sexuality. There's a lot going on in the undercurrents there that I hope to put people more in touch with, or people are in touch with, and I hope them to help to untangle all that's tangled up. This is what I find in the therapeutic sense is what it is mostly it's helping people get clear about their desire and then untangling all that's and meshed with their desire that's holding it back or limiting it or restraining it. Get rid of those elements, then you can be freely in your authentic eros.
So what will the readers be finding when they open this book? Is this a how-to book, self-help, or combination thereof?
Well, the premise that I work from is that every person is unique, and what I am doing in the book is helping them find, understand that there's maps, you know, that you can create and find your own maps to understand your own personal sexuality. You know, I believe sexuality is personal. It's just as distinct as a fingerprint and as inherent as your eye color. And so there's a broad spectrum of that that is also in the collective side of the coin, so to speak, i.e. there are a lot of similar people. That's why people can meet and connect and hook up through these pantheon of fetishes that might exist out there. But it's also very personal. So the first stage is to get in touch with one's personal authentic eros. And I look at kink as what I call a mythically driven eros. You know, sex is friction, eros is myth. When one is engaging kink, they are actually entering into an erotic, mythic, archetypal level story that they're entering into with a counterpart to their main character, along with dialogue, props, attire, body language, intensity, you know, emotional intensity, range of intensity, and such. And that's why there's such a pantheon of these kind of archetypal characters. If you look on FetLife, there's groups, you know, of every stripe you can think of. The classics are daddy, daughter, master, slave, etc. But, you know, there's a thousand different spins on that, that, you know, there's pet play and just degradation, humiliation levels, on and on and on. And the interesting thing, if you look on those groups, they're populated with people on both sides of those equations. So it's in the gene pool as I look at it. So, like, no matter what variation one has, there seems to be in the gene pool a range of other characters, counterparts. That's why people are able to find each other in a way that's never been possible in the history of civilization, really, right now. This level of matching erotic myths is occurring in a way that's never occurred before. And matching erotic myths is very important to successful relationships. That's why so many people are in dysfunctional relationships, because they asked every question imaginable with, except, what's your sexuality look like? Do you like to be beaten? Do you like to get throat fucked? Do you like it really hard up the ass? Or are you submissive, dominant? I mean, so, and even though those people are that, they didn't check it out. So now 20 years later, they're in a relationship and they're out sneaking and hiding and trying to fulfill this innate part that won't go away. But they haven't been able to be honest about it. And so they wind up with a partner that is horrified, maybe, by what one's authentic desire might be.
And they go through phases of total repression, and those phases often end in overindulgence and excessive risky behavior.
Yeah, good point, because that is exactly, it goes through that spectrum of either they're acting out in dangerous, risky, out of integrity ways, or they're shoving it into some other energy. You know, it's energy. It's going to go somewhere. They're going to become overeating or drinking drugs, or shut down, cut off, disconnected from their body, not go totally no sex at all. But these are all unhealthy ways to deal with the sexual dishonesty.
So the direction you are taking this is, we're all creating myths in our minds that expresses the sexuality that we have. Am I understanding this correct?
Almost. I would just change that a bit to be, we are discovering what is innately true. You know, these are coming from internal. It's not like somebody's taking it on externally. So they're coming and discovering or letting embody what's really true when they're having sex. So for instance, like in vanilla sex, say when I was in vanilla sex, my authentic sexuality would only show up in that last minute before orgasm. Before then, I was holding it back, not letting it be shown, not letting anybody see what was really going on. But suddenly it's like, you fucking can't just be, you know, in that last minute, my body would be enlivened and vocalizations would occur that were not my normal everyday persona. They're what I call the sex creature. Yeah, it's very connected to this primal, primitive, instinctual, beast-level aspect of our humanity. You know, these are undercurrents of mammalian, alpha, beta, pecking order, gestures, the physical gestures of that alpha or beta in the mammalian codes. And then, and those are the hot-blooded dimensions of it as I look at it. Then there's also the reptilian brain, you know, activated of the cold-blooded predator, prey, sadist, masochist level. So these energies are part of our consciousness, part of our, mostly our unconscious, really, but they also show up in our everyday life and all everyday occurrences, not just kink, but, you know, these gestures and, you know, getting the way we get angry or display things, you know, these are part of human behavior, but we want to cut off that. No, we're civilized. You know, we don't do that. Animals do that. But in truth, we're still very much close to the animal side of our humanity.
So we back away from our authentic self to be, quote, civilized.
Exactly. you know, that's where we've put ourselves, our cult, this culture we are in, or put us in this position where, oh, we're refined, civilized people, and we're not animals anymore. And there's just then that puts the animal into shadow. That's why the world is running amok in sadism, you know, blowing the hell out of everybody and everywhere, and using muscular solutions to all our problems, and in the thinking that that's, you know, we're civilized people and that's what we do. But that's why it comes out of shadow. That's why I think kink is therapeutic, in the sense of where that energy in us, our shadowy ways of dominating or bullying or being the tyrant, or that can come out in this conscious, consensual, negotiated way in a kink scene, where I can be the tyrant. I can be the motherfucker. I can be the asshole. And my partner, oh, God, I love it when you're that way. Because she knows that that's not what I'm bringing into our relationship context. I'm not operating on that. That's why I divide kink into DS and BDSM. They're two different aspects of kink in a relationship. You know, there's the dominant and submission side, which I look at as the noble, sacred side. And this is where, you know, there's negotiated agreements. As a dominant, I'm totally protective of my submissive. I'm ensuring that there is no, above all, it's like the Hippocratic Oath, above all, do no harm, you know, when I'm engaging my submissive. And it's respectful. It is, you know, I want to be a good listener. I want to be noble in my dominance. The BDSM side, though, through negotiation, once I have established this realm of DS, you know, where my partner trusts, we have good connection, we have negotiated, things are clear, then we can enter into the BDSM side, what I call the erotic BDSM side, and enter into this place where I can be the, you know, shut the fuck up and get on your fucking knees now, bitch. And that's not how I would talk to my submissive in our everyday life. But in this erotic container of BDSM, that, and through negotiation, I can let those parts of me manifest, you know, embody, speak, and they know what to say. They know how to embody. They know exactly how to hold those kind of energies. And the odd thing, and this is what really a big part of the mystery of kink is why is that erotic? You know, that's still being discovered. We don't know exactly, well, how that is eroticized, but the point is it is. You know, hundreds of millions of people are entering into this dimension of sexuality.
You know, it's very interesting. The way you just laid it out is the first time in 20 years that I've heard it clarified to that level. I've always heard B&D, DNS, S&M as a unit, but it's really two separate units.
How I look at it, yes.
You really clarified that for me.
Thank you.
In your practice, you find people that are struggling to reconcile these two manifestations, and are they feeling guilt after the more primal aspect manifest? Is that a common occurrence?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, and sometimes I think it's being captured in this term sub-drop or dom drop.
Yeah.
And I think to a great extent what that is all the parts that, you know, and these are like, and I talk about these mythic structures in the unconscious, and I talked about them in terms of sexuality. These are also parts of the parts of us that are our inner critics, our inner judges, our inner mother or father whose messages are still being carried within us, who for a while, moments while we enter our sexual container, our sexual expression, we might have that our sexual desire might be strong enough to just kind of push them aside. In, you know, in that internal chatter will stop. Will be, you know, that's why people do get kind of cathartic in BDSM, is because of they're finally fully present. That means this future or past thinking isn't going on anymore, or the judgments aren't going on anymore. But so then when they leave that space,
which is often orgasm or some type of cathartic release.
Yeah, exactly. And that's totally a limb. They're not in any kind of shame-based energy or fear-based or any of those things. They're totally in their breath, in their body, present, just now-ness. But as you were saying, though, when they re-enter the everyday world or a few days later or something, those parts that said, oh, good girls don't do that. You're just a fucking whore. You're going to go to hell. These are strong and potent internal messages that are below conscious level. It's not like we're hearing them exactly, but they also have, they have the ability to send the body into these states. You know, the energy drops, the shoulders drop, the eyes look down a little bit, the just, you feel a little depressed. You don't know why. It's just this, I don't know, I just, you know, that's because they're being assaulted internally by this shame and guilt and fear. If they haven't resolved it, it depends on how everybody's got their own personal experience. It's going to leave a different level of that, but hardly anybody is able, has escaped that kind of energetic in our culture, I believe.
You enter this primal state, and then you have to come back to the real, I don't want to call it real, but the day-to-day state that we are in, and we're bombarded by these messages that of what is acceptable and normal behavior. We're from our way our employer treats us to the way that our friends and family treat us. These are parts that we can't share with others, so they must be bad.
Yeah, and that's really what I talk about of untangling things from one's authentic desire and paradox is, so for instance, you know, yeah, how can I be, go to the PTA meeting, be a good church member, be a spiritual person, be a conscious person, all those aspects of our humanity that, you know, we aspire to, and how can I also be this person that likes to be degraded and abused and called filthy names and have all my holes filled up, you know? So the truth is, again, it's the paradox. Yeah, you are both of those, and one doesn't negate the other. You know, they stand independently and they can be combined and are combined. People do it all the time now, but internally, it is still a struggle for a lot of people to not. And I think a lot of people don't even understand this idea of paradox. And that's why they have such a hard time and getting pulled on. And again, we talked about it earlier. This is an and position, not an or position that we are putting ourselves into.
Do you think that the ever-growing reality of community where people are finding fulfillment of more parts of themselves. I notice a lot of people are surrounding themselves with friends they find inside the kink community as their day-to-day companions. Do you think this will ease this struggle for people, or will it be such a small group that it won't have a great impact overall?
I think that it, in all these situations, I think community is important, very important. You know, this is why kink has risen to the prominence, or you know, every city now will have a kink community of some sort, or events and munches, and it is risen to that level. I think what the next stage is to take that community to a more conscious level. Because there is a certain relief just to step into a place where it feels like, I can be just who I am and have my kink and do it all that, and everybody's happy and fine doing that. But the reality is, if we're not addressing what held us back from doing that for the previous decades, in many cases, we're going to start to run into these things. And this is where projection, I mean, the kink community, like any other community, the amount of politics and ruffled feathers, and you know, we're not really any more conscious than any other group, really, until we start doing our personal work and not being throwing it out onto the community at large. So there's a certain risk, I think, in being in community if you're not doing what I call your personal work on the journey here.
And this journey is something that I believe a lot of people can benefit from being more deliberate in their approach, instead of just piecing together things that they accidentally pull together over time. If they're more deliberate, I think that their outcomes will be better for them.
Yeah, and that, you know, so this is the hard part of the journey, really, I think, as community. You know, the kink community has been really good at teaching technique and different toys and tools and edges and, you know, safety and all of those important aspects. That's what I've witnessed, at least in the focus. I've been in the scene since the late 90s. And I think we're just in the last 5 or so years, I'm seeing much more things showing up about conscious kink, you know, bringing a whole different level of awareness, you know, kind of bridging these energies of the sacred or the spiritual dimensions, you know, deeper psychological states, and understanding the relevance or importance, at least for allowing that into the ends of the community that are seeking that out. And I think ultimately most people are seeking these very deep and meaningful experiences. And I think it also part of the education needs to be to help them recognize, oh, you can go way deep into this. It isn't just like surface level, topping, bottoming, you know, getting flogged, all this, which are a certain dimension of it, but there are much deeper places that you can journey, which are very enriching and empowering to the individual.
If they're brave enough and conscious enough to reach and explore them.
Yeah, and in some ways you don't have a choice. You know, I mean, these parts of us are powerful. What I call the sex creature, you know, is a powerful part. It is kind of connected to that primitive instinctual part, but it's also much more, like I said, in these mythic realms. You know, that's what's interesting about kink. One of the things in my research, I have a research survey called Discover Your Personal Erotic Myth that has over about 2,300 participants now have taken the survey, and it's a tool I use to gather data about trying to understand the sexual unconscious, particularly the kink levels of the sexual unconscious, and the challenges that people face in reaching these places.
This survey, Discover Your Personal Erotic Myth, this gathers data to help create a larger, more detailed picture of the way these pieces fit together?
Yeah, it introduces people who haven't really accessed the close by but not fully consciously aware parts, like I talk about in those 60 seconds before orgasm, sound bites from the personal erotic myth are showing up. So I help people drill down from that sound bite into more of the storyline and the characters and the prop, the dialogue. These are all intact in the personas that are showing up. If one has a personal erotic myth, they can discover it through this.
Don't most people have that myth, or is this a portion, only a portion of the population?
That's part of the research. I don't think anybody can answer that, technically speaking, from a data-driven perspective. I think it is clearly a healthy portion of the gene pool. I would guess a minimum of 15% based on just some of the research and other things I looked at, such as, for instance, if the gay and lesbian population is projected to be around 8% or 9% or something. I think this is a spectrum in the human sexual and human within human sexuality that is kinky. I think it may be very high or is across the board. I can legitimately say 15% is not an unreasonable guess of how much of the human population is quote unquote kinky.
I've even heard it up around 20.
Yeah, I'm being intentionally conservative because I don't want to speculate too hard, but I think that's, and it might even be 50. Who knows? I mean, if you read the research, some of the research I've seen, for instance, around the prevalence of rape fantasies in women, is almost 50%. That's meaning consensual. They're not interested in by being violated, but if they could have a sexual fantasy, it carries into that.
And that fantasy is usually about driving their select partner to the point that he loses control and takes her.
Or it could be a gang, you know, walking down an alley. And I mean, it has a lot of variations that when I've met with or counseled or guided women, and that's one of the, been the most gratifying parts of my being in this realm of as a therapist, is what women have revealed to me about their sexuality, and they are fucking perverse. I happily so, you know, no less than men in my experience. I mean, the range of women's kink is outstanding.
They paint the male as a sexual beast, but I tend to agree with you. The woman is the equal to the man in that realm.
Yeah, and that's been so pleasant to find out as a lifelong seeking that, you know, and also feeling like, oh, that's, you know, I've carried my own shame or guilt or fear about judgment, about being coming out. You know, I've been out since 1998 publicly. And that's been a blessing because now it allows me to be in the public sphere and advocate and speak and write. And, you know, I lecture at universities and on programs such as this. And I'm in a position where I don't have to hide who I am. I can say, use my real name and put myself out there. And it's a huge blessing. I was totally severely outed and almost and lost everything right out of the gate. So it's been a huge turnaround from that start to where I've been able to take it.
And we need more out people that are educated and articulate to help the public understand that we are not these villains that they would paint us as.
Yeah, and that's all. That's what it, like I said, this, the origin of this was in the gay and lesbian movements in the 50s and forward, you know, where kink is, has to get political in that sense of where these are, there is a war on sex, as Marty Klein, another PhD psychologist, wrote a book called that, you know, on the political and policy level fronts, that these, it requires groups like the National Coalition for Sexual Freedom and other groups that are stepping in to advocate intelligently, bringing wisdom, bringing research data and other levels of credibility to withstand the assault that, you know, like I said, if this next election goes in one way, the assault is going to come hard, I would imagine.
I am heartened, though. Every time we declare a war on a concept, it totally fails. The war on poverty, failure. War on terrorism, not going so well. War on drugs, not going so well. War on hunger. So war on sex, this may be a good thing.
Bring it. Sex will win.
Yeah. Let the government declare it, because the more they repress us, the more it comes out. But going back to your earlier, I think the population is closer to every sexually active person is kinky to some degree.
Well,
it
that's
all
what
depends
it is.
On how you spell this. It depends on how you define the spectrum.
You know, a simple scarf covering the eyes as a blindfold could be very tame to a lot of people, but it's kinky.
Right, and that's even within, again, when we talk about the distinction between BDSM and DS, you know, there's a broad range in the DS or MS orientation. There are some people who could maintain or try to maintain a near 24/7 state of that mythic concept of a slave. And there's other people who, and this is where I think, again, a lot of confusion, people don't get that, or how I look at it anyway, to make it, I think, more day-to-day reality, is the range of protocol as I look at it. So if I have a part of me that, yeah, I can be the master, I can hold the energy of a master, whatever that, and even that's why I said it's personal.
Whatever that means, right.
Master isn't like something, oh, I get the book, well, how do I do this? No, you discover your own master. Who are you as a master is what I offer people, how to step into that. What are your protocols, your ranges, etc. But once you define that and you negotiate with your slave or submissive, dom or master, all those edges, then you can use ranges of protocol to really fit into your reality, you know, like, okay, so this weekend we're going to have high protocol. That means whatever that looks like for you, but your high protocol can go. Maybe you can, because most people can't sustain 24/7 master-slave level interactions, even if they aspire to it.
I don't know anybody that can maintain a 24/7 state of anything.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't want to have that. That's like, I don't need that level of responsibility to just, you know, carry it on.
Mothers complain constantly about the 24/7 state that they're having to maintain. Parents have that problem. When we go to work, we can't maintain that 24/7 state of our employment. So we all have to have some kind of escapes.
We all have to sub to our bosses.
Oh, tell me.
Yeah.
Tell me.
Galen, as we start to wrap up here, so your new book that just came out at the end of last year was...
Let me give the subtitle to that, if I can.
Okay.
Decoding Your Kink, Guide to Explore, Share, and Enjoy Your Wildest Sexual Desires.
Very provocative title. But you also have another book that came out way back in 2000, The Sharp Edge of Love.
Yes. My first starting to map out what I got to with Decoding Your Kink was an examination of Anna and an honoring a blessing of four distinct submissive women that I had engaged with in my initial journey into my own understanding and awareness, discovery of my kink sexuality. And that was what was so amazing. I was just, these women were so profound, beautiful and intelligent and wise on one hand, and totally perverse and filthy and nasty and dark-edged on the other. And I really just wanted to celebrate how the beauty of that dimension of women's sexuality, as well as map my own journey. I mean, it parallels, I mentioned earlier, I had gotten outed shortly after I stepped in. And in that outing process, I got totally annihilated in the public realm, the courts and the legal system. But so part of that is in the journey. There's a lot of short erotica in there from both myself and the submissives. And it was a very highly well-received book at the time. People can look it up on Amazon and or on my website and see the reviews and get other information about it.
Well, we want to thank you for being our guest tonight. This was a fascinating interview. Boy, I learned a few really good things that will stick with me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure hanging with you guys.
Thank you.
So let's do it again. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much.
All right. Good night now.
You have been listening to episode 111 of the Kinky Cast. For more information about this show, go to kinkycast.com. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of Woody, the Beast, and all our Kinky crew, I'm Max. See you next week when we bring you Master John and Slave Amanda from Chicago.